Thanks for joining us. I'm Catty Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane's taping a programme with Maria Hinojosa at WGBH in Boston. Novelist, poet and all-round lover of language, Paul West suffered a massive stroke in 2004. At the age of 74, he was left only able to utter a single syllable. His wife, the writer Diane Ackerman, witnessed his stroke, and over the next 6 years she helped him regain his use of language. Her new memoir, 100 Names for Love, tells the story of his recovery and how their relationship evolved. Diane joins us now from a studio at WLRN in Miami. Diane Ackerman, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And I do hope the weather's nice in Miami. It is absolutely miserable here in Washington.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
We will be taking your calls, comments and questions. 1-800-433-8850 is the phone number. drshow@wmu.org is the email address. And, of course, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Diane, I was reading your book last night. It is absolutely lovely. And it strikes me that as much as anything, it is a love story, really.
Oh, yes. I think above everything else, it's the crazy love story of two very playful, eccentric, romantic people who are completely obsessed with language.
You write that your husband, Paul West, was the most deliciously quirky person that you'd ever met. Tell us a little bit about him.
He was a real British eccentric out of myth and legend, you know, straight out of a P.G. Woodhouse novel. He only ever wore swimming shorts in the summer, even to formal occasions, and velour jogging suits in the winter. He was afraid of to be in the presence of fresh fruit. He only liked going outside if the weather was mild. And he had lots of other eccentricities, but he came from a very eccentric family, too. So he came by it honorably. It was typical for him, growing up in the British Midlands, to go visit his aunts and uncles and find them napping in the living room, naked but with books, open books, covering their privates.
I know the type from my own family as well. 2004, take us back to that date. You were already in hospital with Paul because he'd had a kidney infection, am I right?
Yes, that's true. And then all of a sudden, he shuffled out of the bathroom and he stood at the foot of the bed and his eyes were glazed and his face was fallen and his mouth was drooping to the right and he looked as if he might be asleep but with his eyes open, and I knew immediately what had happened, that he'd had a stroke.
And how did you know?
Well, because he had had a TIA, that is a transient stroke, a few years before. And that's the kind of stroke where the blood has stopped going to a certain part of the brain, but then it returns and you recover from those symptoms. In this case, I didn't know, was he having a TIA again or a full-blown stroke?
And what did you see? I mean, so you're looking at Paul and he's just shuffled out of the bathroom. And describe his face to us.
Well, he moved his lips a little and he made a sound that was kind of like a buzzing sound. And I thought at first that he might have a mouthful of bees. It was a strange thought. And then I felt ice going up my spine and as if the floor had just dropped 20 feet below me. You see, I had just been on a book tour for a book about the brain, an alchemy of mind. And so I knew in chilling detail what had happened in his brain. And that if indeed he was having a full-blown stroke, that this was not something that one totally recovers from. All you can do is improve once you have serious brain damage like that. I was the best and the worst person in the world to have a spouse with a stroke because I also knew what's now referred to as neuroplasticity. I knew that everything we had learned about the brain when we were all growing up, that it was rigid and you were born with all of the neurons you're ever going to have, and if you lose them, you're in deep trouble. I knew that that wasn't exactly right, that the brain has a great gift for healing itself, for mending itself. And what neuroplasticity means essentially is don't lose hope, that there are parts of the brain that can take over for wounded parts.
You knew an awful lot, and you knew when you were watching him going through this what was happening or what was potentially happening. What did Paul know at that particular moment? Could you tell from looking at him what he knew or whether he was aware of what was happening to him?
I couldn't tell at the time. It was only much later on, when he was able to speak again, that he was able to tell me that there was a pandemonium light show taking place in his brain. He felt his teeth blink, and he heard many voices going around that he couldn't identify. He thought that he was speaking normally, and that for some perverse reason, people were pretending not to understand him.
Amazing.
But in truth, all that was coming out of his mouth was one syllable, mem.
And he thought he was speaking normally and couldn't realize why you weren't responding to him then.
That's right.
But so it didn't dawn on him from the feelings that he had in this pandemonium light show that you describe that he was going through a stroke.
No, because you know when someone has a stroke, the brain is so confused, it's inflamed and it's starved of oxygen, and all of the senses get tuned up very, very high. That's typical. Things are too bright, too loud. There's a lot of cross communications taking place, and the absence of a lot of sensory cues to things going on. So his brain was quite scrambled at the moment.
Was he scared at the time when he described it to you, looking back at it, now that he can describe what he was going through? Was it a scary feeling or was it an exciting feeling? How did it feel to him emotionally?
He said that he was really very scared, and he assumed it was the end for him. He didn't know what had happened. He felt like he had landed on an alien planet, and everyone was speaking a foreign language that he couldn't understand. And also numbers on clocks, for example, didn't make sense. They reminded him of the runes, so-called, that were discovered at Area 51, you know, supposedly left by alien spacecraft. So you can see that he was very, very confused. But almost immediately, he heard three separate voices speaking in his brain. One was the voice of a BBC announcer from his childhood,
right,
a man named Snag. And one was a kind of barbaric sound of the sounds he was making. And the third was a slangy American.
So strange. And so then you're in the room. You go and rush out, call the nurses when you realize what's happening. They bring
yes.
back the doctors and they start doing tests. And what was the diagnosis?
Well, the test revealed that he had a massive stroke, one that was just tailor-made to his own private hell. In the cruelest of ironies, you know, when you think about it, for a man whose entire life revolved around words, but also whose romantic life revolved around words, he had damage almost exclusively to the language areas of his brain, and he could no longer process language in any form. It's called global aphasia. And it really felt global. It felt like it was the end of our world when I heard this. A lot of people, you know, have aphasia. And I knew because of my brain study that he had joined an unlikely club, a club, by the way, that Representative Giffords now belongs to as well. There are millions of people who have stroke every year, about 5 to 6 million people who are stroke survivors. And of those, a vast number who have language problems. But it isn't only the elderly. The Pentagon reports that 200,000 of the young soldiers return home with traumatic brain injuries every year, and outside sources have put the true figure a lot closer to 400,000.
And explain something to me about aphasia, Diane. Is it actually that when somebody goes through a stroke or has a trauma, such as Congresswoman Giffords or the people returning from the battlefield, have they lost the language? Is that what's happened to them, or is it something slightly different?
It's not exactly a loss of language. It's a retrieval problem, a sorting problem. So the words are crowding one another, and very often only the wrong words are the ones that the mouth can utter. And they can be hilariously funny and charming. And over the years, we've really grown to appreciate them. But at the time this happened, suddenly his whole lifetime of words had vanished. And he couldn't speak or read. He could no longer understand anything that anyone said to him. And this was especially tragic for him because he grew up in a British coal mining village, but he got a scholarship to Oxford where he studied English literature and languages. He was fluent in French, Greek, and Latin. He was in the RAF where he was an officer who lectured on giving good lectures. And he taught at university for 30 years. So his entire life revolved around books and around words.
Incredibly cruel irony, as you say. Did he have any other physical problems?
He did. There's something called procedural memory, a memory of how you go about doing things that the brain knows. And that was damaged, too. And so he could no longer remember how to comb his hair, how to swallow food, how to steer a spoon to his mouth, how to use the toilet, how to walk, how to lift up one foot after another to walk. And these were all things that he had to relearn in rehab.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. The book is 100 Names for Love. Diane Ackerman is my guest here in the studio. We're going to talk about Paul's rehabilitation, how you sat with him and helped him recover his use of language. The number here is 1-800-433-8850. Do stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay of the BBC, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined me and my guest, Diane Ackerman. She is the author of 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and The Language of Healing. It is the story of her husband, who suffered a massive stroke back in 2004, and how she helped him recover his use of language. Diane, we were talking before the break about the symptoms that Paul had when he suffered his stroke, and you mentioned right at the beginning that he could only utter one syllable, mem. How did he use it? How did he communicate with just one syllable?
He used it with different inflections to mean absolutely everything. It meant, take me home. You know, you, if you think about it, you can go, mem, mem, you know, mem. He was angry with it. He was soliciting with it. He used it in every way he could think of. And this is not all that unusual. The famous poet Baudelaire was left only saying the word goddamn. That was especially awkward since he was spending his days in a rehab place run by nuns. And they thought that he was blaspheming all day. But we don't really know why this happens, but sometimes the brain gets stuck.
And he knew that he was just saying this one syllable or not? Was he aware that this was all he was uttering?
He knew that even though he heard the correct words in his mind, all that was coming out was Mem.
Incredibly frustrating.
So think how frustrating that was for him. It was just horrifying.
Diane, you've obviously done research on this as well, and you've written, as you said earlier, about the brain. Recent studies have changed, haven't they, the way that we believe the neural pathways of language work?
Yes, they have indeed. We used to think that there were just specific language areas, very small areas that controlled language. And now we understand that there are key language areas, but that so many things happen through networks in the brain, neurons that are associated with each other. They don't even have to lie next to each other. They can be pretty far apart. And we've also found that you can persuade kind of limp neurons that were injured in a stroke to come back to life a little bit, and that you can count on some unused ones to come in and take over for others. Now, this doesn't mean that it's curable 100%. Paul is still aphasic today, but you can improve so much. And that was something that I told him very early on, because when he could utter a few words, he asked when he would get completely well. And I had to explain that a stroke isn't something that you completely recover from, but you can improve so much, and we were going to work together to get back as much improvement for him as possible.
Diane, you said earlier that in a way you were the best person and the worst person, because you'd written your book, An Alchemy of the Mind, so you did know what you were witnessing. But did also your knowledge, as you started the recovery and the rehabilitation process, did having that knowledge kind of give you faith or hope or confidence to carry on working with him, where some other people might have said, oh my goodness, this is just too devastating, I don't understand it, and I don't believe that he's ever going to recover from this?
I think that happens all the time, that people feel quite understandably overwhelmed, shell-shocked. And the brain is a mystery that very few people understand anyway. But as you say, I just happened to have been reading lots of studies and knowing that the brain could repair itself in some ways, but that it was going to take marathon work on my part and on Paul's, that gave me such hope. It really motivated me to keep on and to keep pressing him and to try to figure out how to keep our long love story alive.
So you got Paul home from hospital, and the process of rehabilitation begins.
And I hired speech therapists. We went through five, and they were very noble-hearted. But none of them really could seem to help Paul in any way. And then one day something happened that really changed the course of our lives together and of his therapy. He was in a little library we have at home, working with a speech therapist, and she was showing him a photograph of a telephone on a table. And she pointed to the table and she said, "What's this?" And he said, mem Sky Largle." And she said, "No, those are nonsense sounds. It's a table. What's this?" And she pointed to the telephone and he said, mem Tesseract." She said, "No, those are nonsense sounds too." And suddenly, I turned on my heel and I went back in and I said, "You know, actually, a tesseract is a real word. It's a three-dimensional object unfolded into the fourth dimension. And in a strange way, that's what a telephone does."
Amazing.
And it began to dawn on me that Paul had been uttering, in the midst of all the gibberish, every now and then some rather large words, words like tardigrade and postillion and things, and that it was entirely possible that even though the words that we learn when we're little in school, words like table and chair, may be processed in the key language areas of the brain, it was possible that the larger, more sophisticated words, or the esoteric words that we learn in our profession, maybe, or a hobby when we're adult, maybe those get stored and processed elsewhere in the brain like a second language. And I started taking over his therapy at that point and trying to tailor it to him. What happens so often in speech therapy, but you know, in teaching of all kinds, is a kind of one-size-fits-all way of doing things. You can either use a lesson plan, or you can figure out how a student needs to learn. And the second is by far the most effective.
Diane, do you think that, that was a kind of breakthrough moment for you and Paul, where you took over his therapy, but where also you understood perhaps where elements of his brain were intact that you could work with, that you could retrieve information from, linguistic information from. Is that something, do you think, that applies? I mean, I have a lot of callers, and we're going to take calls fairly soon in the program, also, of course, with experiences of this. Is that something that you would say to everybody giving care to somebody that suffered something similar to Paul, that you need to find the areas you can work with, and they may be different for every single person?
Not only do you need to find the areas you can work with, you also need to find new ways to re-inhabit your lives together and to show affection and to communicate. I was in Boston recently, and there was a couple, the husband which had aphasia, and they reported exactly the same thing happening, that he had retained access to some of the more sophisticated words that he had learned.
How did you cope? You write in the book that you found respite in nature, that noticing a sunrise or hearing a bird helped you.
Well, in the beginning, all I could do is just go home and wait and wither. But I have always in my life transcended by going out and communing with nature, and it really helped enormously to do that. I think it's very important, though, that caregivers know that caregiving is hard and that you really have to give yourself a break, give yourself room to breathe, and breathe deeply. Meditation helps a lot. Time to be out with friends, and time not to be talking about your loved one who has an illness, just time to nourish yourself as well.
How easy was it for you to focus on the present and the future with Paul and not get bitter or resentful for the things that you had lost, the past that you had changed now?
Well, first I must say that it is completely normal and okay for people to feel resentment and bitter about what they have
lost
and anger, because otherwise, you know, a caregiver can feel so guilty. All of that is normal. But I personally found that there's a big difference in a relationship if somebody is acting in a difficult way out of bad character or out of spite, and if they're acting that way because they have been injured or because they're sick. Everything calmed down in the way I responded to him. We don't have any children, and we used to tease that we stayed together for the sake of the children. Each was the other's child. And I found that I really loved mothering him and providing care. And all of those aspects of caregiving, even though I must say that there are so many other aspects of caregiving that are very, very difficult. I shouldn't understate them, because a caregiver is dramatically changed by the culture of illness, just as we're changed by the era in which we live.
You talked earlier about Paul's brain and the language, and realizing that when he said the word tesseract, that he was actually saying a real word, that this wasn't, as his speech therapist had said, a nonsense sound that he was making. You also write in the book about being in the swimming pool, and that this was a physical environment that he found comforting or stimulating in some way.
You know, I also had become aware of this when I was writing a book about the senses many years ago, that if you turn off some of your senses, you can encourage a remaining sense to really focus better. And in the pool, maybe it was because he was floating and the water was warm and he wasn't really thinking about much else, he could really pay attention. But in all fairness, I had also hired the most wonderful and cutest nursing student, who is a self-described chatterbox, very smart, great gift of the gab. And she would show up each day in her bikini and swim with him for a couple of hours, talking nonstop. I thought it would encourage him to pay attention.
And did it?
It sure did. So in the swimming pool, he really found it a little bit easier to talk. He also found it easier to talk first thing in the morning. A moment ago, I said, you know, couples have to find other ways to communicate. And we couldn't communicate so well through words. So I started crawling in bed with him every morning and initiating a tradition that has endured of cuddling for about, oh, half an hour to an hour every day. And in that kind of sleepy, cozy, not quite awake time, he found it easier to find words. Because if people have seen the King's Speech, it's like stuttering. The more stress you're under, the harder aphasia is.
I'm Caddy Kay of the BBC. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to call us, do join us. 1-800-433-8850 is the number, or send us an email to drshow@wmu.org. We're going to go to the phones now to Dan in Alexandria, Virginia. Dan, thank you for joining The Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
We can.
Great. When your husband had his TIA, what were the symptoms of it? Because I had a TIA about 3 years ago, and what was startling about it is my wife was with me at the time. Fortunately, she was driving, but I was making a phone call, and I could actually hear myself talking gibberish, although I thought I was actually speaking in regular language.
And Dan, sorry, one second, just before I bring Diane into this, have you made a full recovery now from the TIA?
Oh, yes, I've made a full recovery. I've had no incidents since. I'm covered for health care by the VA. I take medication to alleviate that. I have like a I have a 50% stenosis in one of my arteries going to the brain. So I've been under care ever since then. And I do live in the fear that this is going to happen again because, as you said, I know in my case, stroke actually runs in my family. It just about killed two of my older family members. So I was just curious. Were you around when your husband had the TIA?
Yes, I was around. And because I've always been interested in how the mind works, how the brain works, as well as how the heart works, I do find all of the symptoms fascinating, including what you've just told me. In Paul's case, he started speaking in a slurred way. And again, his eyes opened wide and he didn't have as much facial responsiveness. But the slurred speech was the giveaway. And I am delighted to hear that you've recovered. Yes, it sounds like it was a TIA.
Let's go to Michelle in Rochester, New York. Michelle, thank you so much for joining the program.
I'm so grateful that you were able to take my call. I have so many connections to this story. I'm a neurologist and a neuroscientist. I actually just happened to be in my car on my way from one hospital to another. I almost never get to catch your show, but I love it when I do. And just in terms of being sort of the best and worst possible person to be in a situation like this, my mother had a brain hemorrhage, a sort of a different kind of stroke than your guest's husband had, where one of the blood vessels in the brain ruptures, and I am now my mother's guardian, and sort of observing the sequelae of her stroke, which ironically are very much connected to the research that I do on behavioral control and impulsivity, and the circuits in her brain that were affected by her stroke have very much to do with the circuits in the brain that are supposed to be helping you make good decisions. And so sort of understanding the processes of the brain underlying what happened and observing the trajectory of her recovery and, you know, something that as part of my training, you really see only the very initial stages of what happens to someone after a stroke, and then they just kind of vanish. And so this very long-term sense of the incredible capabilities of the brain to have all the other brain cells chip in and figure out who's going to do what for whom and how that can get tipped over very easily if there's an infection or she had to have surgery to have her hip repaired. And all of those things took us, you know, several steps back. But then over the course of, I mean, it's 8 to 12 to 15 months for her to make, regain some of the ground that she loses when she had these incidents. But the capability is still in there. There's so many connections I have to your guests, and I know the very next book that's going to be on my bedside table, and I'm so grateful that I caught your show.
Well, Michelle, the book is 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing. Diane Ackerman is the author. Diane, listening to what Michelle was saying there, one thing that struck me is that actually we should realize that progress can be made.
Absolutely. I'm so glad she called because, you know, we hear so often that there is a window of opportunity after something like a stroke happens. That's what I was told, and that's what I read in all of the books, and it's still being taught today, that whatever you haven't regained in the first 3 months, you're not going to. But you know, that just is not the truth.
We're going to take a quick break, but I want to talk a little bit more about that and the progress that Paul has made since his stroke in 2004. Just after this break, the number is 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wmu.org is the email address, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Do stay with us. We'd love to hear from you. We're going to have a quick break.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Constant Contact, offering an event marketing service that provides registration tools to small businesses and nonprofits. ConstantContact.com. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Tina Fey talks about her new memoir, Bossy Pants, about being a boss, writer, actor, daughter, and parent.
The mother's prayer for its daughter. First Lord, no tattoos. May neither the Chinese symbol for truth nor Winnie the Pooh holding the FSU logo stain her tender haunches.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Cathy Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm. You've joined our program with Diane Ackerman. She is the author of 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and The Language of Healing. It's a book about her husband's stroke, but it is also a love story. Let's go straight to the phones to Robert in Orlando, Florida. Robert, I think you have a question for Diane.
Yes, first, I tell you, this is a wonderful program, and Diane, I appreciate the information you're sharing with us.
Thank you.
You've answered a lot of questions that have been in my mind. I have a very good friend that had a stroke 4 months ago. He's been in a subacute rehab facility on Medicaid in the state of Florida. And while we have seen some progress, we were told exactly what you said. If you don't see any within a three-month period, there may be very little progression. The concern that I have and his family has is that with that type of an attitude and not having that level of hope, the feedback we get from him as he mumbles to us is it's a mill. They don't put in the time. They have so many patients they have to see that we get our 15 minutes and they move us next exercise that's being done. What could we do to improve to speed up, improve, and support his rehabilitation privately?
Well, one thing first is to make sure that you're in the best, that he is in the best place for him. You know, you can go around and take a look at a few different subacute places and speak with the speech pathologist and find out exactly how much rehab they're going to get. But I think it's very important in that situation, if possible, to have somebody with him, somebody, a friend, a family, an aide, if you can hire one, because, of course, they don't have enough staff for the patients that they're dealing with there. And I found with Paul that it helped to absolutely saturate him with words. That was critical to his improving. And I talked to him all day. Liz, who is still with us, God bless her, spoke with him all day long. I encouraged him to watch movies at night and television. I made up a homework for him that would be more interesting, more, we were saying, tailored to him as an individual, and things like that, just to keep stimulating the language areas. But going back a moment to what you were told about recovery, important gains can be made a year later, 5 years later, 6 years later. They may not be as big as early on, but they can be so meaningful. Paul, not too long ago, learned how to write a check, finally, how to use his checkbook, because math also had gone out the window. And I can't tell you what a thrill it was for him to be able to have control over that part of his life.
Diane, tell me a little bit about the nature of the care. You suggested that Robert trying to get supplemental care, obviously not everyone can afford to hire somebody in, but it sounded actually like in the case of Lizzie, for example, she wasn't necessarily a super expensive specialist that you'd brought in, but actually just getting somebody who can come regularly and talk, literally, like you said, talk and talk and talk to the patient, that can help too.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I know of a professor who had a stroke recently, and his students have been taking turns staying with him. And there are other good reasons for this, just because in the early stages, the patient may be confused, and somebody staying there overnight could be very helpful if they try to get out of bed or something like that. Unfortunately, healthcare costs today dictate the length of time that stroke survivors are able to have rehabilitation. But just because, even, you know, when they get out of rehab, that doesn't mean the rehab should stop. And because they have a certain amount of rehab when they're in a subacute facility, that doesn't mean that you can't be in there talking with them anyway and encouraging them to talk to you. But it's a good idea to get in touch with the National Aphasia Association. They have a website, and they can give all kinds of suggestions for how to talk with people who have aphasia, how to help them, and also many links for getting in touch with caregiving organizations in the community. There are so many places out there where you can find help and support, and no, not necessarily expensive.
And maybe, for example, a student who is studying this particular field would appreciate the opportunity also to get that kind of practical experience.
It would be a godsend for them.
Diane, if you had to draw a trajectory, a graph describing Paul's progress since 2004, what would that graph look like?
Well, It has been very slow. It was very slow in the beginning, no question about it. And then, as I said, I insisted that he just be saturated in language. But part of that, given who he was, is that when I saw he was remarkably depressed, and by the way, I made sure that he was on an antidepressant, because people do get depressed after a stroke, and because certain antidepressants are thought to help stimulate the memory center of the brain. When I saw that, I asked him if he would like to dictate a memoir, an aphasic memoir, an aphasic novel, and he could barely speak. But nonetheless, I had him doing that with agonizing slowness and frustration. He couldn't write longhand yet, but he could try desperately to find the words. And all of this, just constantly getting his brain to do language, it did work, but it took a while. And one of the things that I did when I heard him say that he was so sad that he could no longer remember any of his pet names for me, is that I encouraged him to make up some new colorful pet names. And with enormous effort, he managed to blurt out one a day for 100 days in a row, which is where the title of the book comes from. And all of them are absolutely wild and imaginative. People who have aphasia very often say the wrong words, and they can say very funny things. And laughter is a tonic in the best of times and also in the worst of times. And it's helpful if you can just open your mind up to the kind of verbal free-for-all and poetry that can come out of an aphasic's mouth.
What were some of his aphasic names for you? What are some of his aphasic names for
Well,
you?
Some of my favorites are my snowy Tanganyika, spy elf of the morning hallelujahs, my, well, you'd have to see me to understand this, my little bucket of hair. My hair is not a hairdo, it's more of a weather system. Lovely ampersand of the morning. Dark-eyed Junko, my little bunko. My billiard table of the decaying gods. Where did that come from? I think maybe my favorite is O Parakeet of the Lissom Star. They're all really wild
poetic.
And we laugh. They're very poetic.
Very
and
poetic.
And I would have to struggle to come up with
anything
phrases
like this.
Anything
like as imaginative.
This. Exactly. But he also, just in the normal course of life, will speak in circumlocutions, and I encourage him to do that. So if he, sometimes they're extreme. He came to me one morning and asked where his cantilever of light was, and I said, do you mean your velour jogging suit? He said, yes. I said, it's in the laundry room. And then we laughed because we had been together long enough that I instinctively knew that cantilever of light meant velour jogging suit.
The advantages of knowing somebody very well. Let's go to Marilee, who joins us from Columbia, Missouri. Marilee, thank you so much for joining the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, you're so welcome. This is just too wonderful. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and Diane, your husband is so lucky to have you because family support is so important, but most of all, seeing that more could be done than was being done by the speech-language pathologist. I just gave a talk recently on functional treatment for aphasia, which is so much more effective, looking at the patient, what his interests are, not looking
Absolutely.
At cards and pictures.
Yes.
That's just old traditional therapy that people shouldn't be using anymore. Medicaid dictates that we have to set these goals, and people are afraid to set goals that are out of the box, but you can measure anything. Our field has just got to get people trained that we need to work with the patient and what he can do and figure out what he's trying to say and not worry so much about whether words are pronounced right if you can guess. But all of the things you are doing are exactly what need to be done with the patient. Let him circumlocute. Let him call you by these wonderful names that he's come up with and accept them. Remove all barriers you can and give a lot of support for communication. We do know now that aphasia is a chronic disease, like diabetes, and we treat diabetes forever, and we should be treating aphasia forever.
Well, Marilee, thank you so much for joining the
that
program.
That was beautifully put.
Very
My
beautifully
hats off
put.
To you.
One question I have for you, Marilee, now we've got you on the program, is there evidence that the type of therapy that Diane has given to Paul, which is very tailored, does produce, better is a subjective word, but, you know, does produce more results?
Yes. We have efficacy studies now that are coming out saying that tailored therapy to the patient's interests. I mean, I have my patients bring in what interests them, and that's what we work on, or what applies to their activities of daily living, and not pictures of somebody writing for them to say the word right, you know, that it's just much more effective because it's a participation level that we're looking at and not a deficit level. And I think the efficacy studies are going to certainly help us with being covered by Medicare by not doing just traditional things.
Marilee, thank you so much, and it was great to have you on the program.
Thank you very much.
Diana, you write in the book that Paul is happier today than ever. How is that?
Yes, surprisingly, the stroke really has brought him a new caliber of happiness. And I think that it's based much less on striving and more on the sheer joy of just being alive and being loved and loving in return on this crazy blue planet. And we celebrate each day together. And our life is not the way it was before, but we've designed a really good life for us in spite of everything. The pet names continue to flow and to flower. A recent one I like is Smooch Owl. And it's really a testament to how a brain can repair itself and, well, how a duet between two lovers can endure hardship also. I say in the book at the end that a bell with a crack in it may not ring as clearly, but it can ring as sweetly. And that is what one has to search for, I think, after a catastrophic illness in the family, a way to continue the everydayness of your life with grace and appreciation and patience and love.
I'm Cathy Kay. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join us, please do call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. We're going to go to Anne in Northville. Anne, thank you so much for the program, and thank you for your patience in waiting for us to take your call.
Thank you so much for taking my call. Hi, Cathy, and hi, Diane.
Hi.
What a pleasure to be able to talk to you. I have been a fan of Paul West forever. I came from Eckington also.
Oh, my heavens.
My mother was a boarder at Ruthin School, where Paul's mother taught piano. I went to Eckington Grammar School, where Paul went, and I still communicate with his cousin Marion. And love all Paul's books. He's a master, was a master, and I think in his own way still is of the English language. And I love your books too, Diane. I wrote to Paul back in 1997. He was kind enough to write me a very nice letter back, which I still have. It's one of my treasures. I want him to know that I am really wishing him well, still loving his books and loving yours, Diane. I went out and got a bicycle after I read one of them. you probably know which one.
Deep Play.
And Anne, what is your last name?
Chowdhury.
Okay, so perhaps, Diane, you could pass those good wishes. And Anne, thank you so much for calling into the program.
Yes, and also, well, thank you so much, Anne. It's nice to hear from you. And if people wish to come... Thank you so much. And to you. If people wish to contact me, I have a website.
Go ahead.
Which is just www.dianeackerman.com.
Diane, you write at the end of the book, you have a postscript, and it is titled Lessons Learned. What have you learned from this process about you and Paul and about the brain and about the process of caregiving?
Well, first of all, number one is have hope. The brain is resilient. It's, yes, an awe-inspiring mystery, but as I said, you can improve function for years afterwards, so have hope. Remember that every stroke is different, and your loved one may improve quickly or may improve slowly. Remember that depression is normal, and look into antidepressants. Rest if you're a caregiver. That's so important. And I confess I didn't get enough of it, and I didn't reach out for help to friends as much as I should have, I think, either.
Because the caregiver is more effective if they are rested and help themselves.
Absolutely. Caregiving is very hard. It's a full-time occupation. Ask for help. There are many social services in all locales, and you'd be surprised how many specific to the problem that your loved one has you can find, and you may meet really wonderful people there in the process. Well, accepting is important because your loved one is different than the day before this happened. But he or she is also the same person, simply on a different trajectory of their life. You know, Paul and I have now been together 41 years, and people sometimes say, well, how have you stayed together that long, been married that long? And the answer is that it's not one marriage. No marriage of that length ever is. It's several.
And
your life changes and so on.
And that I think, is something that everybody can learn from, stroke or no stroke. Diane Ackerman, the author of 100 Names for Love, A Stroke, A Marriage, and the Language of Healing, it's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
I'm Katty Kay, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks so much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.